Thanks for joining A&M Conversation With, a podcast series featuring Alvarez and Marsal leaders discussing the trends impacting businesses today. In this episode of A&M Conversation With, David Gruber, a managing director with our healthcare industry group, sits down with managing directors Peter Urbanowitz in our healthcare industry group and John Cox in our public and social sector group to discuss the most recent updates in the revised American Healthcare Act. What will its implications be for low and moderate income Americans who are dependent upon Medicaid and the health exchanges?
Thanks, John and Peter, for joining this podcast. We last spoke in mid-March upon launch of our report titled Repeal and Replace Implications for Medicaid. Since then, it appears that the American Healthcare Act has been revived with passage by the House on May 4th. So, Peter, how does version 2.0 differ from the bill that did not pass the House on March 24th?
Well, David, it differs in just a very small way with two amendments, but they were two amendments that were critical to round up the votes from the very conservative members of the House, Republicans, and the more moderate Republican members to get the votes necessary to pass the bill. So the first one, which has gotten a lot of media attention, is an amendment on pre-existing conditions. And what this does, if you may remember, under the Affordable Care Act, one of the key provisions of the Affordable Care Act is that individual insurance policies could no longer have a pre-existing condition rider on it. That is, let's say you've been treated in the past for cancer, you've been treated for a heart condition, or for a pulmonary condition. Insurance companies in the past could impose a pre-existing condition rider that says, we will cover your health care expenses, but we won't cover it for that pre-existing condition, your cardiac condition, your pulmonary condition, either for your lifetime of this policy or maybe for a one-year waiting period or a two-year waiting period or something like that. Well, the Affordable Care Act got rid of that and said that insurance companies had to cover everyone for all of their conditions, including pre-existing conditions. Obviously, a very popular part of the Affordable Care Act. There was a large portion of the conservative Republican conference who thought that this pre-existing condition provision in the Affordable Care Act was actually contributing to rising insurance premiums under Obamacare, that insurance premiums were being priced to cover those people who had pre-existing conditions. And if you didn't have a pre-existing condition, you were paying twice, three times, four times the amount of coverage that you would have paid before Obamacare. So what this amendment does is it permits states to go to the Secretary of HHS and ask for a waiver so that insurance companies in that state can go back to having pre-existing condition riders. The second amendment, which was key to getting this passed, was once that amendment was agreed to, and in order to not lose other votes, Congressman Fred Upton asked for an amendment to expand funding for these high-risk pools. Those are pools in state that cover people who have chronic conditions or pre-existing conditions who can't otherwise get health care insurance coverage. And so it provides an additional $8 billion in funding for these high-risk pools. So with those two amendments, Speaker Ryan was able to pull together in a squeaker vote enough votes of his conference to get the bill passed in May that he couldn't get passed in March.
And Peter, is passage of the House bill solely tactical, an extreme case subject to negotiations in the Senate, or can it realistically serve as the basis for a final bill?
Well, they've been talking about, you know, the Senate's going to do a complete rewrite. They can start from scratch on a bill and then, you know, send that back over to the House or send that to the conference committee. I don't know that they're going to start completely from scratch, because they'll look at the parts of the bill that from the House that they philosophically agree with, or at least there's a large contingent of the Senate Republican caucus that agrees to. One is Medicaid reform. You have deficit hawks in the Senate who very much believe that by expanding Medicaid, Obamacare continued to blow a hole in the federal budget by significantly increasing federal expenditures for Medicaid. And they'd like to get control over that. And the way to get control over that is to go to some kind of block grant funding or some kind of cap on funding, which the House bill did. So I think there's some general broad agreement on principle, even in the Senate amongst Republicans, that there needs to be some kind of control on Medicaid spending. How that happens or how the Senate decides to do that is subject to looking at and subject to question. But I think they have broad agreement on that. I think the other agreement that they broadly have is moving from subsidies for those individuals who get individual coverage. They can't qualify for Medicaid, but they need assistance for individual insurance. So moving from subsidies under Obamacare to tax credits under the House bill, I think that's something that also resonates and has support in the Senate too. So maybe it's just a matter of upping the tax credits and moving it from, you know, $2,000 or $3,000 to $5,000 or $10,000 for seniors. I think there's broad philosophical agreement in that. The one sticking point will be what to do about this pre-existing condition amendment, because that has gotten so much attention in the media and how the Senate deals with that. But I think on fundamental principles like Medicaid reform and tax credits versus subsidies, I think you'll find a lot of support in that amongst the Republicans in the Senate.
Thanks, Peter. And John, so what happens from here? Can you provide a framework of what appears doable?
Yes, I agree with Peter that I think there will be some amendments and adjustments in the Senate. But one of the things our listeners should understand is when the Affordable Care Act was originally passed, it was passed under a set of rules in the Senate called reconciliation. And reconciliation, it's very arcane, but it simply means that you can pass a spending bill with 51 votes as opposed to 60, so it's not subject to the filibuster rules. That's how the Affordable Care Act was passed, and therefore undoing or repealing or replacing or repairing is going to be done under the same method. So no Republicans voted for the Affordable Care Act, and likewise, it's very easy to predict no Democrats are going to vote for any repeal or replace. The importance of that is that you're walking a very fine line, and Peter has used the phrase, and I've heard others as well, it's really going to be threading the needle to make enough amendments or changes so that you don't run afoul of the reconciliation rules. So that's number one. Number two, what's doable, I think Peter's exactly right. I think there will be some type of Medicaid reform. It really is a once in a generation chance if you're a deficit hawk to rein in entitlement spending. One could certainly argue even before the Affordable Care Act, Medicaid was growing faster than federal revenues by a lot. Congressional Budget Office, who has gotten a lot of attention for scoring the bills, they put out a report just in January that said Medicaid is going to grow for the foreseeable future 10 plus years at 5% a year. And since it's a federal state shared program with the federal government, very few states are growing at 5% a year. So it's just as a fiscal matter was not sustainable. One other thing on the doable versus non-doable, I think a couple of points are interesting to note, and that's doable in the bill, which we just discussed, and then doable operationally once passed, assuming it does pass. A lot of conservatives like the personal responsibility provisions, and what that means for our listeners is having people that are in Medicaid, enrolled in Medicaid, pay some type of very small premium and or copay. And there are provisions in the bill to allow states to do that, number one. Number two, there are penalties if you drop your coverage and don't make premiums, 30% penalty, if you will, to get coverage again. So those are personal responsibility. Another one would be work requirements, which the bill also speaks to. Interestingly enough, a study just came out in the state of Indiana that over 50% of the new Affordable Care Act enrollees Indiana sought and applied for and got approval for a waiver for their program, 50% of those new participants were dropped to a lower tier of coverage. So they didn't drop total coverage, but they dropped a lower tier simply because they either failed to make an initial premium payment or at some point did not make a premium payment. Why is that important? That's important because obviously Vice President Pence was the governor of Indiana who put in the waiver, and Seema Verma was a consultant for him. Obviously, she's now the new CMS administrator. So it's just interesting to note for our listeners that personal responsibility provisions sound very good and are sort of raw conservative principles, but sometimes they can be very difficult to implement. The final thing I'll say is the bill calls for 6-month eligibility redetermination. What that means in plain English is you have to determine if you're eligible for Medicaid every 6 months. That, again, is pretty onerous on states, even though there's some additional funding provided. So, again, stay tuned for some of those operational details that may get worked out in the Senate.
And the last question, John, is do block grants and or per capita allotments appear to be an eventuality? And what's the significance for safety net providers?
I think that block grants and or per capita allotments, both of which are included in the House passed bill, are absolutely an eventuality. As Peter mentioned, if you're a deficit hawk, this is really a chance to control the growth rate, not cut, but to control the growth rate of entitlement programs. And that means a lot of changes for states. There's a lot of nervousness in state communities and Medicaid directors. And I think that ultimately what that means is they're going to have to be a lot more careful about eligibility. They're going to have to look seriously at who's covered and who's not. And that will be a very interesting part of the equation going forward. But it absolutely is going to be a very different sea change with the way Medicaid is run, which today is an open-ended entitlement.
Thank you, John and Peter, for this timely discussion. It appears a bill focused on Medicaid reform is a real possibility. As a reminder, A&M has published a report on the implications of Medicaid that is available on the About section of this podcast episode. So thank you, everyone, for joining us today.
For our listeners, for more information, visit our homepage at alvarezandmarsal.com and connect with us on LinkedIn at Alvarez and Marsal.